I'm happy to be with you. And you've given me a rather large task to cover 20 years in an hour's talk or so. I would urge you to jot down your questions, and maybe I can try to answer some of them at the end. The best I can do is try to give you a rather general picture of the situation, and at the same time try to characterize the developments during this period. I'll have to give you some facts and figures. I'll also have to try to relate our history to the times in general, as well as to the times and developments in the church world, and especially in the Reformed church world, both here and in the Netherlands. You'll have to bear in mind my viewpoint. After Reverend Waldenberg's remarks, I'll admit to being 60 on my next birthday. So the Protestant Reformed churches were growing up in this period, and so was I. I was a boy of 7 years old at the beginning of this period in 1930. And toward the end of the 30s, I was in my high school years at Grand Rapids Christian. And I was beginning at that time also to become theologically aware and interested in church affairs. During the 40s, I was in college and in seminary, graduated in 1947, entered the pastoral ministry in 49. So naturally, during that period of the 40s, I became more and more personally involved and also knowledgeable, not only as an observer, but to an increasing extent as a participant in the history. At present in our churches, I am the only one of the active ministers who dates from before the 1953 split. At the same time, being a son of my father and living most of this period in the First Church parsonage, I lived rather close to the center of things and was able to learn and to observe the developments in our churches and to participate to an extent firsthand. And as I grew up, I also did participate from that vantage point, so much by way of introduction. Let me begin by talking about the developments in our churches during the 1930s. I would characterize that whole period broadly as a period of growing up for our churches. To understand that, let me try to sketch the situation in our churches at the beginning of this period. We had a small group of churches. Most of those churches were very small congregations, sometimes 12, 15, 20 families. All of them had been organized as a direct result of the events in 1924, when our churches had their origin. There was First Church, which of course was by far the largest, 400 to 500 families at that time, closer to 500 than to 400. There was Hope Church, which was the original congregation of Reverend Uphoff, a small and struggling congregation over on Wilson Avenue, west of Grand Rapids. You have to remember, Wilson Avenue at that time was a dirt road. Then there was Roosevelt Park, which is now known as Southwest Church, on the southwest side of Grand Rapids. There was a congregation in Holland, very small. If I remember correctly, they met for a long time in an old bakery building. There was a church in Hudsonville. There was the congregation down here in Kalamazoo, which was organized with, I believe, 11 families after the departure of the Danhoffs from our churches. There was a church in Oak Lawn, Illinois, the west side of Chicago. There was our congregation in South Holland, very small at that time. One more congregation in the Grand Rapids area, that was in Byron Center, to the far south of Grand Rapids. Then in Iowa, there were Dune and Hull, two names which you won't recognize now in our churches, Rock Valley and Sioux Center. We had congregations there. They were all in about a 20-mile circle in northwest Iowa. And there were Pella and Oskaloosa within about a dozen miles of each other in southeastern Iowa. We still have a congregation in Pella. Oskaloosa disappeared in the split of 53. And for a very little while, we had a congregation in Waupun, Wisconsin, not far from where our Randolph Church is now. During this time, as far as the organization of our denomination is concerned, there was one General Classis, which met, I believe, three times a year at that time, two or three times a year, at which there were two delegates from every congregation. And there was, alongside of that, what was called a curatorium, which was in charge of the seminary, and which in those years met at the same time as the classes did, and also in those years conducted the examination of candidates. During this time, we had 10 ministers. There were the two original ministers, Reverend Herman Hoeksema and Reverend George Uphoff, the older ones. They were young men at that time, too, you know. And all the rest of the ministers, the other eight, were very young men, fresh out of school. There were several who had graduated in 1929. During this time, we had no home missionary. Almost all of our home mission work was done chiefly by Reverend Herman Hoeksema. He would frequently be released for 4 or 5 weeks by the Consistory of First Church to go somewhere in the country, usually traveling by train and answering a call for help from people who had been attracted to the position of our churches. Sometimes he had the help of an area minister, if it was near enough by. And during a period like that, he would often lecture some 20, lecture and preach some 20 to 30 times. And the gathering and the organization of a congregation often took place during that period, such a short period of 4, 5, 6 weeks. I remember distinctly one time, I forget what place it was he had been to, but he'd been gone for 4 or 5 weeks like that. Our family were often missionary orphans in those years, and my mother was left with the children. But he had been very busy, lectured 25, 26 times, preached, and he came home and got back into the swing of the work in the large congregation of First Church, and one of the elders said, "Yeah, Dominie, you had a kind of a nice vacation, didn't you?" Must understand, of course, that during this time it was possible to gather and organize a congregation rather quickly. For one thing, because all our home mission work was done among Christian Reformed people who were concerned about the issues of 1924, who were rather well acquainted with those issues and interested, and therefore it was possible to approach these people and to instruct them and visit with them, discuss with them very easily. And they were, in many instances, very ready for a change as far as their church life was concerned. And as I said, the occasion and the reason for the formation of these churches would be their agreement with our Protestant Reformed position. They often knew of this through the standard bearer. And so these churches were rather readily and quickly organized. The standard bearer at that time was a very important instrument in making known our position in Christian Reformed circles. There's something else that you have to keep in mind, which you probably cannot even imagine anymore today. At least most of you can't. And that was that the Dutch language was very, very much predominant in these years. During this time, even in Grand Rapids, there was much Dutch. First Church had 2 Dutch services every Sunday, along with 2 English services. And these Dutch services were not attended by just a handful of people. There would be an audience of 500 to 700 people at a Dutch service. Most of the outlying churches, especially in Iowa, had at least 50% Dutch services. Some of the churches had 100% Dutch. And in the early years, there were even some congregations in which catechism classes were taught in Dutch. You young people, I'm sure, cannot imagine that, learning catechism in Dutch. It was a bad thing. I mean that catechism was taught in Dutch because the children simply learned their Dutch catechism by rote, and they didn't even know what it meant, which meant that they were not well instructed either. I'll tell you a story about that. In one of our congregations in Northwest Iowa, the minister wanted to prove to the consistory that it was not good to have catechism in Dutch and that they should consider changing over to English for the sake of the children and young people. So, while the elders were visiting catechism, he asked the questions out of rotation. And the children thought they were answering the questions in rotation. So he asked the question, Wie heeft de hemel en aarde gemaakt? Who made the heavens and the earth? And the catechumen answered, Moses and Aaron. That convinced the consistory that it was time to change. It was a time also of transition from Dutch to English, and sometimes this transition was the occasion of rather fierce struggles in some of the congregations. During that time, the standard bearer was also 50% or more Dutch. On the mission field, Dutch was commonly used, especially in places like Iowa. Lectures would be conducted in Dutch. It was still possible to get a church full of people for a Dutch lecture in those times. And many of our earlier brochures and booklets and pamphlets were written in Dutch. The theological school in those days met in First Church basement. It was a very busy place. The instructors were very busy. Reverend Hoeksema and Reverend Opoff, who had to take care of this instruction alongside their pastoral work in the congregations, alongside their preaching, alongside their writing, and their mission labors. But our churches had seen from the outset that it was of the utmost importance that we have our own school to train our own ministers for the newly organized churches in those days. No denomination can long continue without its own source of ministers. There's one more item, I think, that ought to be mentioned in connection with the situation at this time, and that is that it was the period of the Great Depression of the 1930s. That's a situation, I'm sure, which no one here but the older ones can even begin to imagine. All through the 30s, there was a depression which dwarfs the recession that they're talking about today. And that really did not end until the very end of the 30s, the time when our country began to get involved in the war economy of World War II. People were poor. And the churches were poor. And I mean poor. People that didn't know where their food and clothing was coming from. People who had to struggle to eke out a living and to support the causes of the kingdom. Let me give you an example. I went to Baxter Christian School in Grand Rapids. At that time, the tuition was $2 a week, not per person, but per family. If you had 12 children in the family, they all went for that $2. But there were many, many people who honestly could not gather together that $2 for Christian school tuition, and who had to be helped by the deacons. We had an organization called the Christian School Benevolent Association in First Church. And every family got one of these round pint ice cream boxes with a slot in the top. And it was pennies and nickels that were saved in those boxes and then collected once a month to gather some money to help people pay their tuition. Church budget was $1.20 a week per family. Many people couldn't pay it. First Church had a debt of $40,000 on their building. They couldn't pay it. The bank knew they couldn't pay it. They gave them a moratorium on their loan through the Depression years. That's the only way they could survive. Hamburger, and you were fortunate if you could afford to eat hamburger, £3 for a quarter on Saturday. And 10 people couldn't get it. That was the situation. But as so often in times of stress, there accompanied that situation a very, very vital interest in spiritual things and a very hearty dedication to the cause of our Protestant Reformed churches among our people. That brings me to the subject of the growth and development of our churches in this period of the 30s. First of all, let me mention the churches that were added during this time. Grand Rapids Creston Church, that was a small congregation on the north side of Grand Rapids, was organized in 1932. That was really a daughter congregation of First Church. A congregation was established in Redlands, California in 1932. Shortly after that, a congregation in Los Angeles, California in 1933. Very small congregation in a big city. And it disbanded after about 2 or 3 years, particularly because another congregation in Bellflower, California, that was a dairy suburb of Los Angeles, was organized in 1935. Orange City, Iowa, was organized in 1934, small congregation, and there was a congregation established in Grand Haven, Michigan, in 1936. For some time, services were conducted in, first in Muskegon Heights, and then in Spring Lake, and finally it centered in Grand Haven, and a small congregation was established there. This was all before we had a home missionary, and the congregations in the outlying areas were established through mission work that was conducted chiefly by Reverend Herman Hoeksema. I remember in 1934, when work was conducted in Bellflower, our whole family drove out there in February and March, stayed there for 5 weeks. Finally, in 1937, we called our first home missionary. That was Reverend Bernard Cook. And he was missionary from 1937 to 1942. He labored in several different places, several of them without fruit. But in this period of his labors, there were two new congregations established. One was in Edgerton, Minnesota, still there, 1938. And the second congregation was in Manhattan, Montana, organized in 1939, and it fell apart in the split of 1953. To this period also belongs the writing and publishing of the first edition of the History of Our Protestant Reformed Churches, written by Reverend Hoeksema, published in 1935. it was felt for the churches and for the future generations that it was very important that the story of the origin of our churches be put down in print. And that was a very detailed history of the developments in the time of 1924 and the early organization of our churches in 1927. And along with that, there was a doctrinal catechism about the errors of the three points. Here and there you can still find a copy of that book. There aren't very many around anymore, except with some of our older people, perhaps. During this time, also, First Church called its second pastor to labor in association with Reverend Hoeksema. All this time, this busy period, he had been preaching three times a Sunday, working in the theological school, writing in the Standard Bearer and in other publications, conducting mission work, and it was time that he received assistance. That was in 1939. Reverend R. Veldman was the first associate pastor of First Church. I personally had much of my adolescent catechism instruction under him. Toward the end of this period, in 1939, there occurred an event that was rather important for the history of our churches at that time and for the history of our churches later on. And that was the first visit to this country of Dr. Klaas Schilder. And that was the occasion of the first personal contact between Schilder and Hoeksema and the other ministers of our churches. I'll have a little more to say about that later, because this turned out to be a very significant event. During this period, I should say further, there was a rather consistent effort on the part of the Christian Reformed Church to give our churches the silent treatment. It had proved unsuccessful on their part unsuccessful to engage in polemics, to engage in battle with our churches, especially on the home mission field. Now they tried to change their tactics and to give us the silent treatment. And they tried much as they could to ignore us, thinking we would go away if we were ignored, perhaps. In connection with our mission work, they often threatened people with censure if they so much as attended Protestant Reform meetings. And in some cases, they actually applied censure. But they did not want to engage in any kind of public debate or discussion or controversy, either in the spoken word or in the printed page. These were also the days when they boldly predicted that our churches would die on the vine, and that especially with the disappearance of our original leaders, our churches would die. During this time, they also very freely called us a sect, both in this country and overseas, and they tried their utmost to ignore us and to belittle us in the hope that somehow or other we would go away. During this same period, there were 10 graduates from our seminary and new ministers for our churches, beginning in 1932 and ending in 1940. And finally, as far as events are concerned, I should mention that in 1932, and to divide our churches into two classes, classes East and classes West. At that time, the Mississippi River was the dividing line. And along with that division into two classes was the beginning of our meetings as a general synod, as we have today, every June. The first synod of our churches met in 1940. Now, as far as characterizing this period is concerned, I think we may say the following. In the first place, it was a period when our denomination became established and settled to a large extent. In the second place, it was a period of considerable growth and development and a maturing process. I said we became established and settled. We grew up. This was achieved really toward the end of the 30s. The period of the 30s in general was a period of development and maturing. In the third place, it was a period when our churches were very much what I would call Netherlands-oriented. And I'm referring not merely to the predominance of the Dutch language among our churches, that too. But that, you understand, was due to the fact that our membership was Dutch. And many of them were first-generation Dutch immigrants. My father was an immigrant, came to this country when he was 18 years old in 1904. But there was a whole generation of people like that, and this was the generation of people that was front and center in our churches at that time. This was very common. And it was common in the Christian Reformed Church, too, at that time. And that very fact meant that these people not only carried along with them to this country much of their Dutch ecclesiastical heritage and background, but that they remained interested in the Dutch churches. And that was the case in our own churches, too. On the one hand, I think that accounts very much for the fact that in those years, we sought, very consciously sought, to be recognized as being reformed by the leadership in the Netherlands, in the Reformed churches of the Netherlands. All our writings in those years, our standard bearer in large numbers, and copies of our various brochures and booklets, were also sent to the Netherlands in large numbers. And those earlier polemical brochures and booklets that dealt with such subjects as common grace and the well-meant offer of the gospel, they were sent to the Netherlands to various Dutch church papers for review. We wanted to have their evaluation of our position, feeling very much that we represented the Reformed position and we wanted to be recognized by our original mother churches as Reformed churches and people. And they paid very much attention to us, too. If you page back through some of the volumes of the Standard Bearers of those years, you'll find that time and again there would be reference in the Standard Bearer to a review of one of our books by some Dutch minister or Dutch professor in one of the Netherlands church papers. And we paid much attention to what they said. And especially Reverend Hoeksema replied to what they wrote and defended our position. And there were indeed some of the Dutch leaders who expressed themselves very sympathetically toward us. That's the one side of that Netherlands orientation that I mentioned. The other side of it was that we, as Protestant Reformed people and churches, took a great interest in theological developments in the Netherlands. There were some important ones. I'll get to that in a little while. But we took a great interest in that. The Standard Bearer wrote about those developments, and the Standard Bearer offered its analysis and its evaluations of those developments to, for the benefit of our own people not only, but also for the benefit of the Netherlands. And it would carefully analyze and criticize the views of various Dutch theologians. That leads me to a rather important aspect of Dutch history, which is intimately connected with our own history. At the time, in the 30s, but also very intimately connected with our own later history, because it involved the friendship of Dr. Skilder. You might refer to this whole aspect of the history as the Dutch connection. During this time in the Netherlands, there was a period of conflict among Dutch theologians. I can't take the time this evening to develop all of that. You'd be here way too long tonight then. But it was a conflict, roughly speaking, between two wings in the Dutch churches. The wing that was represented by the Free University of Amsterdam, the Abraham Kuyper wing of the churches, and the wing that was represented by the Theological School of Kampen, the Netherlands. This would be the Hendrik de Kock wing of the churches, related to the secession of 1834. There were many theologians involved, but there was especially a Dr. Hepp, who was professor of dogmatics at the Free University, and Dr. Skilder, who was professor of dogmatics at Kampen. This was also the period when there was developed in the Netherlands, began to be developed, what was supposed to be and what started out to be a Christian philosophy. Maybe some of you young people occasionally have heard about the AACS in this country, or what's sometimes called the Toronto Movement. I'm sure Reverend Woudenberg has. But that movement here is connected with a philosophy that was developed among, in the Netherlands, I should say, by especially two men of the Free University, Herman Dooyeweerd and Theo Vollenhoven. They were brothers-in-law, those two men. And the development of that purported Christian and Reformed philosophy also occasioned conflict. But there was considerable conflict, and it took the form especially of a pamphlet war in the Netherlands. And Hepp and Schilder were a couple of the main writers. Besides, of course, Schilder was writing in his paper at that time, the paper called the Reformatie. And the conflict in those years centered especially on five doctrinal issues. One, strikingly enough, was the subject of common grace. The second one, and this became an important one later on, was the subject of the covenant of grace. The others, which really don't enter into the later conflict very much at all, I'll just mention them. Self-examination, the subject of the immortality of the soul, and the subject of the natures of Christ. As I said, there was a pamphlet war. Pamphlets and brochures and charges and countercharges about these subjects flew thick and fast in the Netherlands. Dr. Hepp wrote a series of pamphlets under the title, what would be in English, Threatening Deformation. And every time he would write a pamphlet, Schilder or someone else would write a pamphlet in reply. But none of this involved any ecclesiastical cases until 1936. And then, without any request, without any mandate, the General Synod of the Reformed Churches in the Netherlands took these five matters that I mentioned and made them ecclesiastical, official ecclesiastical matters. And they appointed a committee that was to investigate these subjects and the conflict about these subjects and to report to a later synod with recommendations for synod to adopt. The report never came. In those years, the General Synod of the Dutch Church met every 3 years. There was no report in 1939. The report never came until the Synod of 1942. I'm running ahead a little bit. I'll come back to that later. But remember, this was the war years. This was the time of the German occupation of the Netherlands, 1942. That synod, called the Synod of Snake, Utrecht, the cities where it met, perpetuated itself until 1944, all the time dealing with these doctrinal issues. And finally, it took decisions, especially on the subject of the covenant of grace and baptism, which led to a split in the Dutch churches and led to the formation of what came to be nicknamed as the Liberated Churches, officially the Reformed Churches of the Netherlands, upholding Article 31 of the Church Order. But those are the churches which were formed following 1944 and which were associated especially with the name of Dr. Klaus Skilder. As I said, I'm going to come back to that subject when I'm talking about the 40s, so keep that in mind. Now, during this time of the conflict in the Netherlands, around 1939, Dr. Skilder made a visit to this country. He made that visit under the private auspices of a Mr. Hamstra, businessman out in New Jersey, an importer, and Mr. William Erdman Sr., the owner of the Erdman's publishing house in Grand Rapids at that time. They sponsored his visit. And Dr. Skilder had expressed himself on many of those doctrinal issues which I mentioned, and he had expressed himself to some extent on the subject of common grace. The intent of this visit was to lecture and preach, especially in the Christian Reformed churches in this country. And you must remember that the Christian Reformed Church and the Reformed Church of the Netherlands, to which Dr. Skilder belonged, where he was an office bearer, were sister churches in what is called full correspondence. So the pulpits of the Christian Reformed Church should have been open to him. But the powers that be in the Christian Reformed Church were deadly afraid, really without any real reason for it, that Dr. Skilder was going to say things in this country which would be contrary to their ideas of common grace. And they did not want their 3 points of 1924 touched by anyone. And so they tried, through announcements in the Banner and the Wachter, the Dutch paper at that time. H.J. Kuyper was editor of the Banner, and Reverend E. van Halsema was editor of the Wachter. They tried to persuade all the Christian Reformed churches to boycott Dr. Skilder, not to have him preach or speak in any Christian Reformed church. And they did this rather bluntly in those announcements. They knew that he was a keen Reformed mind, that he was a sharp polemicist, a capable fighter, a man who spoke his mind, and just because they feared that he might disagree somehow with common grace and might agree with the Protestant Reformed, which he didn't, at least not initially and significantly. Fact of the matter was that Hoeksema and Skilder had crossed swords more than once in the Standard Bearer and the Reformatie in their writings. But because of that fear, they wanted to boycott him. The boycott didn't succeed. And it didn't succeed, especially not in the Grand Rapids area and in any area where our churches were, because our churches and our people invited Dr. Skilder to lecture and told him that he was free to say whatever he wanted. We weren't afraid of what he might say about common grace. We could stand on our own feet. That was our attitude. And when they saw that our churches invited Dr. Skilder, there were many of the Christian Reformed churches who were shamed by it and who, after all, invited him to speak and even to preach in their churches too. And Skilder did speak. He spoke to large audiences. Mind you, this was all in Dutch. You can't imagine that anymore today. But I remember when Dr. Skilder was here in 39, I couldn't understand a word of Dutch then yet. I learned my Dutch when I went to college. But I remember the visit. In those days, First Church seated 1,250 people in their regular seating. They had chairs, extra chairs, all over that auditorium in every available nook and cranny, and even on the platform, so that Dr. Skilder could hardly get to the podium to speak. And they had loudspeakers in the basement for another 100 people, and the whole auditorium was jam-packed for a Dutch lecture. And that happened repeatedly in that time. What was important at this time was that we began, our churches, our men, began to have personal contact with Dr. Skilder. As I said, I didn't know any Dutch at that time. But even then, I could tell that he was a very personable and attractive man when he visited in my parents' home. I remember distinctly that all our ministers had a conference with Dr. Skilder in my father's living room and discussed issues, discussed things such as common grace, and that Dr. Skilder made a very congenial impression, but also that our men, in their questions and discussions, made a very favorable impression on Dr. Skilder. Remember, we had been belittled as being a sect, as not being part of the mainstream of the Reformed churches. And when Dr. Skilder visited with our men, he found an entirely different situation. Then came a very important event. At the initiation of Mr. William Erdman, Sr., with the cooperation of Dr. Skilder, they conceived of the idea of having a large conference between the Christian Reformed leadership in the Grand Rapids area, the professors and ministers, and our Protestant Reformed leadership, and as many of our ministers as were able to attend. And this conference was to be held in the presence of Dr. Skilder to give him the opportunity to comment and advise. And the original purpose of it really was to, and I think it was a pipe dream already then, but nevertheless, the purpose was to try to bring about a reunion between the Christian Reformed and the Protestant Reformed churches. Again, the main segment of the Christian Reformed leadership shied away. They had their various reasons or excuses, but the professors, for example, of Calvin Seminary, which were at that time men like Professors Berkhoff and Volboda and Weingarten and Clarence Bauma, they wouldn't come. The editor of the Banner would not come. There were a good many Christian Reform men present. Dr. Henry Beats, who at that time was Secretary of World Missions in the CRC, was there. In fact, they made him chairman of the meeting. The late Dr. Hendrickson was there, and there were several others who came. Our ministers came. Reverend Hoeksema prepared a thorough conference paper on the subject of reunion with the Christian Reformed churches. Is it possible? Is it desirable? And he dealt with the issues, with the history, with the injustice of the procedures in 1924, but especially he dealt in a very thorough manner with the doctrinal issues involved in common grace. And that paper was, of course, originally in Dutch, later translated and printed in a booklet form in English and in Dutch. Once in a while you can find a copy around someplace yet. Very helpful little booklet if you could ever get a hold of it, because it tells the story of our position in a nutshell. But Reverend Hoeksema was the only one who was prepared at that conference. And the Christian Reform men admitted that they were not prepared. And after some opportunity was given to Dr. Skilder to make some remarks about Hoeksema's paper, and he made them, and he came right out without agreeing on the subject of common grace, he came right out and said openly that he had learned some things about the whole matter that he never knew before and had never heard before. And he came right out and testified, regardless of any differences on common grace, that our position and our men in taking that position were reformed. But they really spent the rest of the day, from noon until late afternoon adjournment, trying to persuade the Christian Reform men who were present to discuss the issues, to discuss what Hoeksema had set forth in his paper, however they wanted to discuss. And no matter how they tried, and no matter how they were urged, these men would not discuss. And finally, the conference adjourned, and they decided to meet at another time when somebody of the Christian Reform group would be prepared to speak, but that meeting never came off. I can remember very well, late that evening, that Dr. Skilder came to my father's door, and he had a terrible, terrible Dutch brogue. But he grumbled to my father, he kept a smoring. I'm thoroughly disgusted. But Skilder got his eyes open at that time about our churches and about the common grace issue. And when he went back to the Netherlands at that time, he had a good impression of our churches, and he began to write about these issues in his church paper, the Reformatie. I'll keep this in mind because Dr. Skilder is coming back into the picture later on.